Hello, and thank you once again for tuning into ReptileApartment.com's The Reptile Living Room. I'm your host, as always, John F. Taylor. And this week, we are brought to you once again by Comic Karma, your comic book journey destination. Give them a tumble, ComicKarma.com. Got a lot of great reviews. Mike's been posting all over the place. Bleeding Cool, spoilers, just all kinds of way awesomeness going on with the comic book industry that you should be checking out. And this week's interview is with Marcia McGinnis of Golden Gate Geckos. You can find her at goldengategeckos.com. She is also known as the Mogul, but you will hear more about that in the interview. It's a very funny story. And Marcia shares with us how she got into breeding leopard geckos. She's breeding a lot of the Australian geckos as well as some African fat tails. Talks a little bit about the politics in the industry, what it takes to be successful in the industry, as well as gives us some tips and tricks on keeping the gecko species that she breeds, and talks to us about doing shows, what that's like, and just a really awesome interview with a lot of information in it. So we hope you enjoy it, and once again, feel free to drop by the blog at reptileapartment.com, leave us some comments, tell us what you think. And we hope to see you at the shows. And we're on a mission to send Marcia to Madagascar so she can actually go out and see some of these really cool gecko species. So get out there, go to her website, goldengategeckos.com, buy some of the awesome, awesome geckos that she has for sale, and look for her at the shows. She's got some shows coming up that she's thinking about doing. So stop by the booth, say hi to her. She's a really, really awesome lady to speak with. Very, extremely knowledgeable about the gecko species overall. Not afraid to sit down with you and share all kinds of information. She's very, very open. So once again, check her out, Marcia McGinnis, goldengategeckos.com. And let's hear what she has to say. Thanks for tuning in. So today we're on the phone with Marcia McGinnis from Golden Gate Geckos, also known as the Mogul, but we'll get to that later, because that's still hilarious. I still love that, but anyway, so as far as, how did you get into reptiles, Marcia? I mean, I guess that would be
it was a long time ago. Well, of course, I've always been fascinated with all kinds of critters ever since I was a kid. I mean, I was always bringing home horned lizards, because we lived down in Southern California, and, my dad was in the Marine Corps, so we lived down near, Camp Pendleton area,
right.
And we lived in out in the desert at 29 Palms, and mm-hmm. we had a desert tortoise named Homer, and, I mean, just all kinds of stuff. I was kind of a tomboy. Of course, that's what they called us back in those days when there was girls that liked frogs.
Right.
And, lizards and stuff like that. So I've always had a fascination with them, and... back in the early 90s, I worked with a guy who had quite a vast collection of herps.
Okay.
And I was fascinated with it. I mean, I've always known people that had, you know, a couple snakes or some lizards or whatever, but he had savannah monitors, he had bearded dragons, he had everything. And
wow.
I was just started to talking to him one time at break and at work, and I said, you know, that's just really fascinating. What would make you want and to have a reptile as a pet? Because I always enjoyed them.
Right.
And we got to talking, I said, you know, I've been thinking about getting a gecko. Not sure what I'm looking for. And he says, well, there's a reptile show coming up at the Cow Palace out here in San Francisco
mm-hmm.
In a few weeks. If you'd like to go with me, let's go. And so we went. And, of course, this was before the Internet, really.
Right.
So there wasn't a whole lot of stuff we could do to research or anything other than, you know, pet stores or talking to other people who kept reptiles.
Right.
So we went to the show, and I bought a couple leopard gecko babies.
Okay.
And the rest is history. A couple years later, they turned out to be two females. And, of course, I did everything wrong. You know, when I was first, you know, keeping them. It's a good thing they're hardy little creatures. And then,
yeah, no kidding.
And then I got a male. And in 1995, I produced my first clutches of leopard gecko eggs.
Okay.
First half of the season, everything failed. Every single egg failed. I was so despondent. I was discouraged. And I finally just ignored them. And then out of the blue, I just happened to check on them, and there were two little babies in there. So, kind of like, I was hooked. I sat in the middle of the floor like a, and bawled like a baby. It was just funny. Yeah, I was just, oh my gosh. So that's when I started learning that, you know, like some people with houseplants.
Right.
You know, they think if a little bit of water's good, a lot's better.
Right.
Or whatever, and then they have black thumbs. They can't.
Right.
Well, I think I was, you know, opening and closing this little, you know, styrofoam thing too often. The temperatures were all over the place, and I was keeping the substrate too wet. And once I just gave up.
Right.
And let the temperature stabilize and quit putting water in there. Voila! Then we had babies. And so I was hooked at that point. And then a few years later, I met, I was starting to go to some of the reptile shows again. And I met Julie from, Julie Bergman from Gecko Ranch.
Oh, yes, Julie Bergman.
And she and I just became fast and close friends, and she actually was the one that helped me. This is actually, I'm backtracking a little bit. She actually helped me. She taught me how to sex geckos.
Okay.
This is a boy, what a boy looks like, and this is what a girl looks like. And I was like, oh, I got two girls. So, yeah, so she'd been at it for a few years, and she was a mentor for me, and we've been friends ever since.
That is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Now, talking about the leopard geckos and stuff like that, because we talked at least once about leopard geckos and their care, and we had a pretty in-depth conversation at the show.
Yeah.
What are some of the best practices that you would tell someone about keeping this species specifically regarding leopard geckos? What are some
regarding leopard geckos specifically?
Right.
Okay. Well, first of all, they really need belly heat.
Right.
I think there's a lot of misinformation out there, especially when people buy leopard geckos from pet stores, or especially the big box pet stores, that, you know, their care sheet, I think, is one size fits all.
Right.
They do need the belly heat, because in the wild, they don't bask in the sun like, you know, obviously, like a lot of other reptiles do to assimilate vitamin D. And in their habitat, they, you know, it's very hot, and they live in rocky sandstone and granite areas. And so when they come out, when the sun starts cooling off and going down, when the bugs come out, they rely on the heat that's been absorbed in the rocks for their tummies, and that aids their digestion, it controls their metabolism, and their immune system.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, ambient temperature, like with overhead heat, is appropriate for a lot of other geckos, or other reptiles, I should say, but not for leopard geckos, so belly heat.
Okay.
And the second thing is, that since we aren't really providing them with their natural food supply, where they come from, there aren't any crickets or mealworms and things like that. They eat spiders and scorpions and locusts and things like that. It's important to provide them with the proper supplementation, which means calcium and a vitamin supplement from time to time.
Right.
Although it is very difficult, for a leopard gecko to develop metabolic bone disease, is it requires a lot of neglect.
Yeah.
So, you know, other than that, I think that their care is pretty straightforward. They don't require any lighting. They live a long time. They're clean and usually select one spot of their environment or their habitat for a defecatorium.
Right.
You know, if they've got fresh water and they're properly heated, which is around 90 to 92 degrees, belly heat in one spot on their habitat, mm-hmm. I don't see that there's any real problem other than those things that I mentioned.
Right, right. Okay. Now, talking about just geckos in general, because I know you worked with a lot of different breeds of geckos.
I work with 7 species of geckos.
Yeah,
right.
There you go. I knew it was a lot. I just wasn't sure what the number was.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to a new breeder that might be interested in getting into geckos? You know, because they come to the show, they see the leopard gecko morphs, they see all these Australian geckos, and they're just like, wow, this is something I really want to do.
Yeah.
What would be your, if you could only say, you know, a paragraph to them, what would you tell them?
Well, first of all, do your research.
There you go.
The Aussie species, with the exception of a few, are not what I would consider beginner geckos.
Mm-hmm.
Their care is a little more sophisticated. But do your research and don't make any impulse decisions. Talk to breeders. Get on the internet. There's a plethora of information out there.
Mm-hmm.
Before anybody gets into any kind of a breeding project, I really think that they should keep the geckos for at least a year
mm-hmm.
and understand their needs and their behaviors and everything else like that before even considering subjecting them to breeding.
Right. Okay. That makes complete and total sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as looking at the whole industry as a whole, what do you see for the future as far as, you know, with all the regulations and stuff that's might be coming down
mm-hmm.
the pipe, may not be, you know, as a breeder yourself, where do you see us ending up here in the next, you know?
Well, it's scary. It's scary, without getting on a political rant.
Oh, sure.
I think that most of what's going on is based on ignorance. And
mm-hmm.
ignorance doesn't mean they're idiots. It just means that they're uneducated.
Not knowledgeable.
And
not, right.
Exactly. It's based on ignorance. And also, it's natural for people to be afraid of things that they don't understand.
Right.
And the best way to get over a fear of something is to understand it, and that's to, you know, to keep your mind open. And I don't see that happening. Or actually, what I'm seeing is more of a resistance because reptiles are becoming a real mainstream pet, if you will.
Yeah, I just saw a report actually yesterday that exotic animals, quote unquote reptiles, are becoming more and more popular. And I was like,
oh yeah,
wow, that's awesome.
Well, I remember, you know, just 15, you know, 16 years ago, people who had them were considered a little bit off.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, I don't know. I resemble that remark. Well, yeah, me too, of course. But no, I think reptiles are becoming very, very mainstream, and the fear of reptiles is not something that we're born with. It's a learned behavior.
Can we talk about that, actually? Why do you think people actually fear reptiles? I've been throwing around ideas on pads of paper for, like, almost a year now, trying to write an article about
mm-hmm.
the fear of reptiles. So now you say it's not an innate behavior.
No.
It's actually learned behavior.
No, I have 4 grandchildren.
Okay.
And all of them are, and nieces and nephews and great-nieces and nephews,
uh-huh.
and none of these children are afraid of my snakes or my geckos or anything. They're fascinated with them.
So the carpet pythons, none of them?
No.
They're totally okay with it?
No, I just had my, 3-year-old great-niece here last weekend, and she was holding one of my carpet pythons, and of course I was helping her hold it,
sure.
You know. No, I think children are fascinated with creatures. They're not afraid of, they're not born afraid of spiders and snakes and things like that. But I think that some of the fear that we develop
mm-hmm.
From our childhood is twofold. First of all, we never hear really anything good about reptiles unless it's a rattlesnake that bites somebody.
Mm.
Okay, and
true.
So it's an innate fear that our parents and schools and everybody has to protect our children, to protect their children, and you know. So there becomes a fear of reptiles at that
okay.
point, and all snakes, you know, are venomous, or all snakes are dangerous. And,
right.
and the second part, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, is
no.
I'm not sure if too many of the listeners know that I'm an ordained minister. And looking at our biblical Judeo-Christian
mm-hmm.
views, when we look at Genesis and the creation, Satan was presented as
yes.
a beautiful serpent to
right.
tempt Adam and Eve.
Right.
And so, therefore, it's we have a you know, a subliminal message telling
mm-hmm.
us that, you know, that serpents are the you know, are evil.
Quintessential evil, right.
Absolutely, right.
Right.
Right. So I'm going to be very frank about that. I just, you know me, I just...
Oh, no, that's...
I just tell it.
Marcia, that's why I love talking to you, because you just, you know, you just it is what it is. You
it
know,
is.
You have no
yeah.
qualms about it. It's just, this is who you are, and this is the way it is.
Mm-hmm. So that's
yeah.
what I think. And
okay.
You know, I've gone out to many schools and stuff and brought my geckos and started out very young with these kids, and we've, you know, done brainstorming up on the dry erase or the
right.
blackboard and say, why do you think people are afraid of snakes? Or why
oh,
do you
yeah.
think people are afraid of reptiles? And I just throw stuff up there, you know.
Right.
I mean, they're slimy. They're ugly. They're poisonous. They'll bite you. They're dangerous. They're,
right.
you know, all of these things.
Right, right.
And then what I do is go through and dispel all those myths.
All those myths, right.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
And then when I bring out the geckos, I say, now, come on, is this is a reptile. Is it ugly?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, especially some of your geckos.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the compliment. But then when I give them, you know, facts like, you know, more people are injured by dogs and
right.
horses, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which we consider to be domestic, everyday animals, you know,
right.
in our lives, you know, compared to, you know, injuries or problems with, you know, reptiles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I talk about percentages of how many reptiles are actually venomous compared to those that aren't.
Oh, God, yeah.
you know, it's, I think that if we can start young enough, you know, that we can present these animals in a factual and realistic fashion.
Right. So it's all
so
about
that
the
future of the herp, getting to your original question, so the future of the herp community or the interest in reptiles and amphibians, I think, is only going to get better if we can nip some of these things in the bud early on.
Right, and basically educate the masses.
Absolutely.
Nice. Now, what made you choose the specific species that you're currently working with, the seven? Now, actually, let's back that up a little bit. What are the seven species that you're working with, and why did you choose those specific ones versus all the hundreds of other animals that are out there?
Okay, well, of course, I work with leopard geckos, and that's
right.
what I started with. And then I work with African fat-tailed geckos. I also work with Native American Southwestern banded geckos, which I just adore.
And you are the one, well, as far as I know, the only breeder working with that species, because the Coleonyx variegatus, and there's a couple other ones that are out there,
mm-hmm.
too. And when I saw your website for the first time, I was like, wait a minute, she's working with Coleonyx?
Yes, I work with two Coleonyx species, right?
I was like, wow,
right.
that is so cool.
Yeah, and then of course, I work with, I used to work with four, but now I work with three, Australian species.
Okay.
Which are the Nephrurus, all are Nephrurus species, so the
mm-hmm.
Nephrurus levis, Nephrurus millei, and Nephrurus wheeleri.
Okay.
And I chose the animals that I work with because, first of all, they're all terrestrial animals.
Okay.
And second of all, I don't have a big facility and a huge, facility that has separate rooms with different environmental, you know, controls
oh, okay.
and things like that. So I chose the species that I work with based on the environment of the area that they're in,
mm-hmm.
Their relative temperature requirements, the humidity, here in the Bay Area runs between 45 and 60% all the time, which is just really nice.
Right.
So I have never worked with any of the arboreal gecko species because of either temperature and or humidity requirements.
Oh, okay.
Not that I'm not interested, or if I was left to my own devices, I could go crazy. But I am a one-woman operation, so...
Yes, which is very impressive, by the way.
Oh, thanks. But, well, but I'd have to work within what's realistic.
Right, right. And now, just off the top of your head, do you know, rough guesstimate, do you know how many geckos you produce every year?
Well, it depends. I've cut down quite a bit. My production is about 50% of what it used to be.
Okay.
So, all in all... With all species, I probably produce only between about 200 and 350 geckos a year.
Only, yeah. Okay.
Only. Well, I mean, I'm not, that's considered modest, actually. I mean, I'm certainly not a gecko mill, and I don't, you know, have, you know 500 breeders. And
right, and that's one of the things that, you know, we talked about at the show was, you know, you were talking about, you know, only producing a certain amount of geckos a year, and I was just flabbergasted. I was like, well, you know. What do you consider, you know, a large amount? And then you started throwing out numbers of people, numbers that other people were producing. And I was like, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, yeah, I'm not a gecko mill.
I'm not, no. And, a lot of people seem to think, I'm a big operation, and I'm really not.
It's
actually what I would consider a modest collection. Mm-hmm. I think I only have about 50 leopard gecko breeders. And a small collection of all the other species that I have, meaning like 2.8 or 3.12 or, you know, so it's I have to work within my ability to care for them properly.
Right.
So
that was the biggest thing, again, referring back to the show when we were talking, that you are more concerned, about the gecko the animal and where it's going and how it's going to be treated versus how that customer feels about you.
Well,
I thought,
you know,
it was just,
well, that sounds kind of extreme, but, I have been fortunate enough in the last 15 years working, you know, being, breeding these animals
mm-hmm.
that, I'm still around, number one. And number two, you won't find any complaints about my animals or my business anywhere.
Right.
So that in and of itself tells me that I'm, you know, thinking in the right the right way. But I don't always subscribe to the customer's always right.
True.
Or the customer comes first.
Right.
My animal come first.
Right.
Period.
Right. Exactly.
If... No ifs, ands, or buts.
Right.
Now, granted, when somebody, you know, calls me or contacts me and orders a gecko from my website or at shows and people buy them and stuff, I can't sit and, interrogate people.
Right, you can't do a two-hour interview, but, you know.
No, and I did when very first show I did. I think I passed up more sales than I made because I was interrogating the people. but, you know, there's a fine line, and after a while you reach a moderate point where you realize that we don't have, or I should say I don't have complete control
right.
over what happens to my animals after they leave here.
Right.
But my responsibility and my ethical responsibility to not only the animals, my customers, and to the hobby itself is in education and
mm-hmm.
and standing behind not only, you know, my animals but my customer service and being accessible to people. I mean, when the sale's over, it's not over.
Right, right.
Hopefully, in many cases, that has developed into some really great relationships with people. And so you're not going to get that at a box store.
Very definitely. Very definitely.
You know, they make the sale, and their
and
whole idea is not to sell the animal, it's to upsell you, so you'll go and buy all the stuff that goes with it.
Right.
And that's not my goal. And so, So, yeah, that's, you know, I don't always say that the customer's right or the customer comes first. The customer comes second, because if my geckos did not come first, I wouldn't have a business and I wouldn't have any customers.
Right, exactly. Now, speaking of customers and interactions with other folks, yes, I do. I have to have you explain
I got tagged with the mogul.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Because that story's hilarious. I'm sorry.
Did you? Oh, by the way, did you look up my website?
Yes, I did.
MeanOldGeckoLady.com?
Yes, I did.
Okay, that's of course that's a farce, but it's fun.
But
it was just
fun.
A fun thing. Well, okay, it's years and years and years ago. Of course, I've been very active on the forums, giving information, helping, and so forth. And there was a guy who was just starting out and came on full guns, like he was Mr. Expert, and that's fine. And he would not take any kind of, he would ask for advice and then argue with you about it, you know, or not take it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was starting to annoy me somewhat, but I'm pretty thick-skinned. But anyway, we wound up online, and it turned out that some misjudgment on his part cost the lives of several geckos, a couple of which were geckos that he got from me.
Ooh.
And so I let him have it. And I don't do that very often. I can probably count on one hand the number of times I've done that, and then I always feel terrible afterwards. But so he came back at me, and he said, "You're just going to be nothing." He says, "You just wait. I'm going to take over all your business and all your customers and everything else, and you're going to be nothing but the mean old, just a mean old gecko lady." And that diffused me instantly, because I thought it was hysterical.
Right.
I thought, I'm a mean old gecko lady. So everybody that was reading this thread that was going on, of course, weren't very happy with this guy, but then everybody started razzing me about being the mean old gecko lady.
Nice.
And then that kind of went down to M-O-G-L,
mm-hmm.
The mogul.
Right.
And it just has stuck for all these years. So that was spawned out of me, you know, severely chastising somebody and him not appreciating being chastised and telling me I was a mean old gecko lady, which I proudly wore the banner.
Yes, ma'am, you did. And there's a website, mogl.com.
There you go. And I am not a mean old gecko lady. I'm really not.
No, but, definitely.
And that's why it was even funnier because people were giving me so much, you know, razzing me so bad about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can imagine, because that is just, yeah, completely the opposite of everything that we ever heard about you and everything else, you know, so that's why
it
was so
funny. Well, it could have really made me mad, but I just thought that was funny. I just had to sit and crack up.
Oh, God, yes, definitely.
Yeah, I thought it was great, and so I've been the mean old gecko lady, or the mogul, M-O-G-L, for years now.
That is awesome.
So I threw up, you know, this website that's the mean old gecko lady, meanoldgeckolady.com, for just as a, I don't know, just as something lighthearted, you know?
Oh, yeah, and it's definitely funny. Definitely listeners should definitely check that out, because it is quite funny. And, of course, all the links go back to your original website.
Of course they do. It's shameless self-promotion,
oh,
for
yeah.
Pete's sake.
But, yeah, that website is pretty funny.
Thanks.
Now, as far as the morphs and things of leopard geckos being produced, everybody seems to be trying to come out with the next best thing. And I want to know from the, you know, pretty much leopard gecko queen, what are people looking for these days in leopard geckos? I mean, as far as breeders are concerned.
You know, I've seen a huge rift in the last several years between morph makers and the traditionalists, so to speak.
Yeah.
It's a shame. It really is. But I think that, what spurned all of this is, of course, and I'm going to, is it okay if I drop names?
Oh, sure.
Oh, okay. Ron Tremper has always been, you know, on the leading edge of marketing and morphology.
Oh, yeah.
And people just salivate and wring their hands and just wait for whatever, you know, Ron's going to, you know, produce and introduce at Daytona.
Right.
And things like that. He's been around the longest, and I think he's probably had the most influence on all of us.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
As far as leopard geckos go, mm-hmm. in history.
Yeah.
And so people started seeing the price tags.
Yeah.
on these new morphs and going, okay, so it was either oh my God, I got to have it so I can produce these things and laugh all the way to the bank, or and this is where the rift, I think, started, or it was, gosh darn it, there's no way I can afford something like that.
Right. Exactly.
And so I think that it was a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. In some ways, where people were either or. There was not a whole lot of middle ground as far as, you know, morph making.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then, of course, you know, the Bell line of albinos came out, and
right.
they were, they were a big ticket item.
Right.
I mean, they were anywhere from, you know, they were about $2,800 a piece when they were first introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And so people saw that and said, oh my gosh, what can I do with this? And then, the Max came out with their Snow and Super Snow line.
Right, right.
And then there, of course, the Enigma, I think, was the last big morph. And what I mean by morph is that they were in and of themselves a genetic morph.
Right.
And so then the morph making started,
mm-hmm.
and that's when the genetics of these animals really started becoming evident.
Right.
And I think it's exciting.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
well, I mean, I'm 56 years old. I went to school. We didn't have genetics when I went to school. We knew, if you went to biology, you knew that a blue flower eventually became a white flower, you know, or whatever,
right.
and, you know, that kind of thing. But I think that there's a big difference in, you know, a new bona fide genetic morph versus combination morphs that are coming out. Because, and then, of course, people started naming their combination morphs something new, okay, you know, and then breeder A called his version of it this, and breeder B called their version of it that, and then
right.
there became a whole bunch of confusion.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's what started some of the rift in the community was the people that were, you know, doing everything, putting things together to see what they could come up with in hopes of, you know, producing the next new morph
mm-hmm.
so they could be, you know, in their minds, millionaires.
Right, right.
And then the people who want to work with these animals just for the sheer enjoyment and beauty of them.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because I know I was talking to a couple people, I think yourself included, they're actually breeding Afghanicus, which
yeah.
is one of the, you know, basically it's the originator of the leopard geckos.
Well, it's one of them.
Or one of them, sorry. And,
yeah.
You know, and I was like, wow. People are
yeah,
actually still working with this species?
Yes, I work with Afghanicus, and I work with my brain just went kaput here. You know, I work with two subspecies.
Right.
And of course I had to bring them in from Europe.
Yeah, cuz you can't right.
And but cuz we can't get them in here.
Right.
And ever since ever since the late 70s and early 80s when there was so much turmoil going on in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
actually the only people or whatever that have been able to go in there and do any field research on these pure, let's just call them subspecies and or localities.
Right, no,
exactly. Has been limited to just the Russians.
Oh.
So, everything has just come to a complete halt.
Right.
as far as studying them in the wild, and the taxonomy on these guys is still, the jury's not in yet on whether they are true subspecies or species in and of themselves or just simply a locality.
Right.
And so we just don't know.
Right, right. Yeah, because...
So the fasciolatus, for example, I work with the fasciolatus, that's what I was looking for,
right.
In Afghanicus, which it looks so far that the Afghanicus is, at this point, is considered a subspecies where the fasciolatus is a locality.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But there's Montanus, there's several different, subspecies or localities
mm-hmm.
out there.
Right.
But most of what we have here in the U.S. and in Europe are all mutts.
Yeah, exactly. No one knows where it came from.
No, they're
what
all
it was bred with. Or,
exactly.
Yeah.
They're just mutts. And so, because of my fascination with the origins of these animals and things like that, I chose to work with a couple of the subspecies,
mm-hmm.
And do a little dabbling and crossing them, and then and mostly just keeping them pure.
Right. Now, what are your thoughts on crossbreeding?
Okay, could you be more specific about crossbreeding?
As far as like taking subspecies and breeding them together and, you know, trying to come up with something new that doesn't, you know, that doesn't occur in the wild, basically. Not necessarily a molt.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, well, yeah. Well, we don't know for sure if, well, like I said, this backtracks to what I was talking about earlier, is that
right.
since we can't get out there to the Middle East and do field studies,
mm-hmm.
We were relying on a lot of the stuff, from the 60s and 70s in wet collections.
Mm-hmm.
And photographs and scientific taxonomy reports and whatnot from different universities,
mm-hmm.
Where they do, you know, they do sublabial scale counts and digit structure and all that kind of
yeah, there you go. To know about.
And stuff, which is overwhelming to most people.
Yeah, I'm one of them.
But until we can really truly determine.
Mm-hmm.
If they are a true subspecies or if they are simply a locality.
Right.
I don't see a problem with it. Now, this to me is, in my mind, is not, it's not making hybrids.
Okay, right.
Is that what you were...
Right, hybrids.
Where
that's
you were going?
Right.
Okay, yeah. No, they're all Eublepharis macularis. I mean,
right.
But the thing is that, in the wild,
mm-hmm.
you're not apt to find any naturally occurring albino.
Right.
Not that it doesn't happen.
Right. It's just very rare.
It's very rare, and of course they're very they're sensitive to light. They would probably be a weaker,
mm-hmm.
Less robust genetically, and either not adapt well or fall to prey or
right.
whatever. So I think that. Until we can get out there and really do some research, it's hard to say.
Exactly.
Now, on the flip side of that,
mm-hmm.
and I'm taking a neutral stance here, not
oh,
deliberately
sure.
not answering your question
no,
about,
not
my, about my opinion on it, because I really don't have one, is that I don't think we're doing anything with these geckos, especially with the line breeding that we do, and that's not
mm-hmm.
to be confused with inbreeding.
Right.
Selective breeding, line breeding, is different than inbreeding line breeding.
Right, right.
In other words, we produce bright red orange geckos because it's a naturally occurring color, pigment in their skin.
Right.
Okay, and same goes for pattern or lack of pattern or,
mm-hmm.
you know, those kind of things. We're not really doing anything that is not naturally occurring
right.
Within the animal itself.
Now, you mentioned, sorry to interrupt you, but you mentioned Ron Tremper earlier. Have you been to his website lately?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
It just, No, I haven't. What's going on?
Well, and it's probably not new. It's just I don't have enough time in the day to go and visit everybody that I like's website.
I don't either. That's why I haven't
exactly.
been there.
there's a leopard gecko on there that has literally a blue spot. And he's, on the website, it says that he is trying to create the blue leopard gecko.
Yeah, he's been working on that for a long time.
Okay, see, that's, like I said, I haven't, you know.
Yeah.
Now,
well,
here's
the thing. I don't know. I've seen a lot of, the same with the emmerines, for example, these beautiful, you know, they have a lot of green.
Right, okay.
In them and stuff, but here's what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just my theory, and I'm not in any way discrediting anyone.
Oh, no, not at all.
I think that if there's something that's worth checking into and investigating, by all means, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that we need to take a look at what's motivating us.
Okay.
Okay, and I'm not going to go elaborate
on
that.
Fair enough. Nope.
However, now let's just look at a basic color wheel.
Yeah.
Okay, we got primary colors of red, blue, and yellow.
Uh-huh.
Then we have secondary colors of red and blue combined making green.
Green, right.
Blue and red combined making lavender,
right.
Or violet.
Uh-huh.
And yellow and red combined making orange.
Right.
Now, if you look at leopard geckos, lavender is a big color now people are really looking for. And the funny
right.
thing is that we used to produce them, you know, 12, 14 years ago.
Right.
And then they kind of went away.
Yeah.
And now lavender is a very desired color.
Right.
But is it truly lavender? So if you look at the basic color of the gecko.
Oh.
Okay, if you look at the basic color of the gecko, which is probably, you know, going to be, of course, we're looking at xanthism.
Right.
And which is, you know, which is the oranges and the yellows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you have a black band on them that fades as the gecko grows.
Right.
And this black pigment starts fading, and it's a layer over another color. It's going to appear...
Lavender.
To be, yeah, exactly. And so, so that's my
theory. Very interesting.
That's just my theory.
Huh.
Now, as far as blue, a lot of people say, oh, blue is not a natural color for a leopard gecko. But if you look at every single baby that's born, they got blue eyelids.
You know what? I never even, you're exactly right.
They look like, what's her name on, what was that one show? Jim Carrey show with, you know, what's her name? And that with had that big blue eyeshadow or whatever.
Oh.
Mimi? Was that
Mimi.
Her name? Yeah, Mimi. Okay.
They do.
You know,
they
yeah.
totally do. It's Mimi.
They have blue eyeshadow.
Oh, my gosh. I never
so
realized
So I'm not,
that.
No, so, and they're, and they come out of the egg like that, okay?
Yeah, yeah
so
they do.
I'm not, you know, so for some people say blue is not a natural color for a leopard gecko. I disagree.
You're exactly right. How amazing. I never even realized that until you just said that.
But this is just my own theory, okay? It doesn't
right.
mean that it's carved in stone and everybody needs to believe it or that I'm, you know, getting in anybody's face that, you know, believes differently. It's just that,
no.
you know, when you look at red, you know, and blue together, it makes lavender. And,
right.
and so when a black band is fading and it has the absence of one color, it's going to give the appearance of, you know, having a secondary color.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's understandable. I can grasp that.
Yeah.
Now, as far as your next show coming up here, when can our listeners run out and clean you out of all your geckos?
Well, I wish they'd come and clean me out of my geckos now, but...
Oh, okay.
I don't... I usually only do local... shows, meaning California shows,
okay.
because I am disabled, and it's hard for me to, you know, vend at these shows. However, I'm thinking about the Las Vegas show coming up in May.
Ooh, that was a good show.
I've never vended it out there, and so it's a consideration.
Okay.
Generally speaking, May, I don't have anything.
Okay.
You know, I don't start having really, you know, I tend to hang on to my geckos a little longer than most people do.
Right.
I still have a lot of 2010 stock left.
Okay.
And depending on how that goes, I may or may not, you know, vend out there. And I believe that show's in May. I don't have the exact date.
Yeah, I think it's in May as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you coming down to the January show in Pomona?
Pomona?
Uh-huh.
That's something I'm looking at again, too.
Okay.
You know, because I do, I have to think about, number one, my health.
Sure.
And it's a, you know, some of these shows are about a seven-hour drive for me. And
oh, yeah, definitely. I understand
all the setup, standing on my feet for 2 days and all that, and
right.
the cost.
Oh, yeah.
So I have to make it,
yeah, these
you know.
Yeah, these shows for vendors can get real pricey real quick.
Yeah, they can. So I have to weigh the, what I feature in my mind of, you know, what is an acceptable
cost
show
effective.
As far as sales go
sure.
versus, you know, the cost as well as the cost on my health.
Right, exactly.
So it's hard for me to commit,
okay.
but I think it's probably pretty feasible that January I'll be down there.
Okay, very good. Now, just for those listeners, because we do have international listeners, you do have a website where you can order and do all the shipping and what have you directly from your website, and that
yes.
is GoldenGateGeckos.com.
Yes, it is, GoldenGateGeckos.com.
There we go. Okay.
I am able to export. I do not have an export a permit, but I do have access to an export permit through PACHRP.
Oh, okay.
To get animals to Europe, of course, I've sent many animals to for delivery or for
mm-hmm.
pre-sold animals for pickup at the ham shows.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, there's an option there, and
okay.
We're just now exploring, you know, some of the Asian markets.
Okay.
And so yeah, that's it's doable.
Now, what is and this is kind of off topic. What is the deal with Australia? Can they import things, or is it just they can't export anything? I don't understand all the shipping.
Well,
and all
I don't
stuff.
Really either, because you know, quite frankly, it's dependent from territory to territory. You know, they have different rules and regulations within cities and territory. You know, that kind of thing.
Right. Okay.
Australia is very, very. How could I say it? They are. Very, very protective of their natural
resources, right?
And their animals are one of a kind.
Yeah.
you don't see kangaroos, and you don't see these animals anywhere just because of the way that the globe has evolved,
right.
And they've been landlocked for so long that these
right.
animals have evolved on their own, which is really remarkable. And I really have to hand it to Australia that they're doing everything that they possibly can to conserve these natural animal the resources, and I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
Probably most of what we have here in the U.S. As far as Australian species go came about before implemented for
right.
exportation.
Exactly.
I think that there are cases on certain species where you can get permits through the Australian government to go in and collect, and they're very picky about who does that.
Oh, sure.
But I also know that the vast majority of Australian citizens themselves can't even keep a lot of the species that are natural to their to their continent.
Right. Right, that's what I've heard as well. That's why I was kind of asking, because I know, you know, it's like everywhere else, you know, we can ship reptiles to, but Australia. So I was like, what's the deal with
well,
that?
Well, and you know, it's kind of like Hawaii, for example. If you move to Hawaii, you
have
to put
right,
your
Hawaii.
Dog and cat in quarantine
in
for
quarantine.
90 days, you
right.
know? I mean, they don't want any, they don't, not only are they protecting their species by you know, not over-propagating them and exporting them, but
mm-hmm.
they also don't want an influx of, you know, non-native species
mm-hmm.
that are going to ruin their ecosystem.
Right, right.
So that's about as much as I know about going on. And, you know, there's still a lot of ruffled feathers over some of the, you know, some of the species, that, the Australian species that we have here in the United States being, you know, descendants of smuggled animals.
Right.
And I don't have an opinion. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't have an opinion on that one either way either.
I don't like to think that we're all, you know, lumped into one category as
right.
being people who, you know, condone illegal smuggling and the rampant, you know, disintegration of, you know, species
of
animals.
Species, right, exactly.
Right, right. So I don't know that that's a fair statement.
Yeah, I personally don't think it is.
That yeah, like that one guy, I guess, or whatever, that got busted coming out of Australia and he had a...
Oh, dear Lord.
What was it? He had a prosthetic leg or something that was stuffed full of...
Oh, yeah. Okay, there was another one, too, that had a bunch of geckos in his underwear.
Yeah, they were tied onto him
yeah.
in his bags. And
yeah, that was awesome. That was good stuff.
Well, I'm sorry. Those people need to be prosecuted.
Oh, yeah, they do. Totally.
And we have a responsibility here in the United States to not do business...
With people who do that.
Exactly. Or even if there's a question in your mind about these importers and where they're getting these animals, I really think they need to be boycotted. But
yeah.
But I'm pretty radical about that feeling, you know.
No, I'm totally, you know, at least every show that I've ever gone to, everybody says the same thing to any new person. Buy captive bred. Don't buy stuff that's imported.
There are enough breeders here in the United States that are deeply committed to their collections and the responsible propagation of them that we do not really need to go out and spend money to import
no.
all this stuff.
Right.
We just don't. Granted, we need good bloodlines, of course, and I'm a hypocrite because I've imported the fasciolatus and the afghanicus, but they are not wild caught. They are descendants of wild caught.
Right, right.
And then, of course, we have a lot of fat tails that come in from Africa that are wild caught. And,
with wild caught with me, it's like, you know, you're taking such a risk because the thing could be so infested with parasites. You introduce that into your collection, you wipe out your whole collection. You know, I mean, there's just too many risks involved.
Well, that is a huge risk, but it goes farther than that, John, and that is that, you know, the way that these animals are collected and shipped are appalling.
I don't even want to get started on that.
I don't either. And,
okay, good.
And then, of course, we take, you know, a perfectly healthy gecko from the wild or anything from the wild, and we subject it to the stress of captive, you know, husbandry.
Right.
And even if they do have a parasite load that is perfectly maintainable and, you know, in their natural habitat.
Symbiotic almost, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Once they're, you hit the nail right on the head, once that their stress levels go up.
Right.
And stuff, then their metabolism doesn't work properly, their immune system starts screwing up, and that just fosters the chances of these, you know, parasitic infections becoming clinical.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, maybe they come in on a subclinical level, mm-hmm. but once they're subjected captive, you know, it just grows out of control, and it's just cruel, and it's just cruel.
Yeah, definitely. Now, before I let you go, there's one more question that we always ask all of our guests on the show. What is, if you're not already keeping it, what would be the ultimate species of reptile that you would keep if money was no object and if, you know, there was no ifs, ands, or buts, you could just keep whatever you wanted, what would that be?
I really, really am fascinated with the New Zealand geckos, the Nulthina species.
Ooh.
And if it were possible to have something like that in my collection, and money was no object, and it wasn't illegal to export them or import them or whatever,
right. Right.
I would work with those in a heartbeat.
Awesome.
Yeah, they are amazing.
Very cool.
Just amazing. But I like looking at people's pictures of them in the wild.
Exactly. Exactly. And Bill Love has quite a collection of
absolutely. Yes, he sure does. You know, there's quite a few people that go out just for the just to go and investigate these species and study them and
hang out,
pictures
watch.
Of them.
Yeah.
And I spend a lot of time. Some people might consider it wasted time. I don't. Just admiring the intrinsic beauty.
Oh yeah.
Of all these creatures, you know.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And I'm very jealous that people, you know, have the wherewithal and financial means or whatever to get out there and rough it to seek them out and study them and take pictures of them. So.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I'm very jealous. We need to go to Madagascar together or something.
That has been proposed to me on a few occasions to go to Madagascar, and you know. I think that's something I'd like to do.
See, I think you just need to make it happen, Marcia. We need to get our listeners on your website.
I think we need to get a big old,
and buy every single gecko that you can.
So many amazingly beautiful, gentle creatures that, you know, it's just awesome.
Yes, it is, definitely.
Yeah, I'm in awe when I think of it.
Yeah, every time I go to the reptile show and I see all these different creatures that, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It's just like, oh, my gosh. Can I just
buy
every single one and take care of it and do nothing with the rest of my life but sit here and hang out with reptiles?
Yeah.
I'd be much happier.
It'd be easy for me to fall into that trap. But to be fair to myself and to the animals that I love and care for, I have to really, I have to really pull in the reins.
Well, Marcia, I know you're a busy lady because you got things to do this evening, but I really appreciate you talking to us.
John, it was great talking to you, and I just felt I've known you forever. And
I think we have. I think we really have.
I think we probably have. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and the listeners and just share a little bit about, and it's just the tip of the iceberg, a little bit about the mean old gecko lady here and I think about and what I love and what I do.
Now,
so
what I'd like
appreciate
to do is ask you to come on again at another time when you might have a moment, because I've heard stories of some type of super slurry that can, like, heal any gecko of any...
Well, yes. Well, I don't think it's contrary to what people might think. It won't heal anything, but it is a life-saving sustenance for geckos who are off food and we can talk about how I came up with the slurry and what I was, one of the things that I went through, which is very, very tragic, almost made me turn my back on this whole, hobby. It was that devastating. It wasn't a parasite or anything like that, but how I came up with the slurry, and now that UC Davis, University of Guelph, Ontario, Canada, Texas A&M, and my own veterinarian and other vets across the country are recommending this slurry as a life-sustaining. It's just amazing the input I get. So we could take some time on that, and I won't take up any more of your time either. But
definitely.
I'd love to come back and talk about that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We will definitely have you back on. And
okay.
Website, one more time, is Golden Gate
www.goldengategeckos.com.
Awesome.
And if you want to have a laugh, you can go to www.meanoldgeccolady.com.
Awesome.
And it's just shameless self-promotion for Golden Gate Geckos.
Oh, but it's hilarious. It's still funny. Thanks again, Marcia, so much.
John, it's been a real pleasure. I could talk to you forever.
Okay, girl. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, so there you have it. That was Marcia McGinnis from goldengategeckos.com. Not sure really what happened there with the little bit of the popping and hissing on our recording on that particular interview. Obviously some technical difficulties, and I do apologize for that to both Marcia and the listeners. Cleaned it up as much as possible, but there was some pretty important stuff in there that I didn't really want to cut out, and you could actually hear, through the popping and hissing. Regardless of all that, once again, we do appreciate Marcia's time. Do check her out at any show you get to. Make sure you look her up, see if she's going to be there. I'm sure she posts the show dates on her website. Once again, that's goldengategeckos.com. Or you can go to the meanoldgeckolady.com or mogl.com. And once again, leave some comments on the blog. Check us out on iTunes. give us some comments, give us some ratings on the iTunes, as well as our reptileapartment.podomatic.com. And don't forget to tune in next week when we interview Scott Pauly of Pauly Exotics, and he talks to us about the green tree pythons, what it's like to keep them in captivity, what it's like to breed them, and everything that goes along with keeping the green tree pythons. Really exciting species, not as hard as most people may think it is to take care of. So tune in next week with Scott Pauly from Pauly Exotics. Thanks for tuning in to ReptileApartment.com's The Reptile Living Room.